Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Dalitz.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. I'm Matthew Dalitz, and I'm here with my good mate, Richard Hill. Howdy, Richard.
Hey, Matt, how are you doing? Another beautiful week.
Yes, yes, doing well. Today, Richard, we have a special guest from Harvard.
Now, here we have somebody quite extraordinary. I mean, I was over the moon about having Joseph Ledoux, and I'm over the moon about having this wonderful guest. Tell us a bit about this absolute, again, trailblazer of neuroscience and neurobiology.
Right. So we've got a Professor John Dowling, and he's a professor at Harvard University. And now I will point you to his extensive history. He's got a very extensive history going way back to the 60s doing neuroscience research. And as we will discover in our podcast with him, he was doing fundamental research and discovering some amazing things which have become the foundation of what we know in neuroscience. So Professor Dowling is a significant figure in the world of neuroscience. And so we've been very privileged to talk with him. And in particular, the reason why we're talking to him today is about his new book, Understanding the Brain, From Cells to Behavior to Cognition.
Yeah, and it's great. It's got a huge technical aspect to it in its beginning, and it sets everybody and gives everybody a fantastic groundwork, and then goes on to talk about all these really important behavioral things, cognitive things, nature of consciousness, of emotions. And it's really great to get a point of view and a perspective from such a wise and really fundamental person in the development of neuroscience in the 20th century. It's amazing.
Absolutely. Now, as we got rolling in this podcast, we talked for about an hour. So we thought we'll break this podcast up into two parts, so we don't overwhelm you with all of the information. So part one this week, part two next week. Now, Richard, we have some training ourselves on our academy. Tell us about the dangers of dopamine.
Well, we'll hear about this through the talk, where dopamine's really important. And dopamine is even more important than I thought it was. So there's a lot to be learnt there, as you read in the book, and we'll listen to John talk about it. But there's for those who want to get back their grounding on the dopamine and the four different pathways that dopamine functions and is utilized by the brain as a functional organizing neurotransmitter. The dangers of dopamine course, go check it out. It's 2 hours of fabulous, well-packed goodies.
Fantastic. Okay, so yes, please do check that out. Okay, Richard, let's go across to Harvard University and let's talk to Professor John Dowling. Professor John Dowling, welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. How are you?
I'm fine, although a little tired. I left Paris this morning at 10 a.m. our time.
Oh, wow. And now you're coming from?
I'm in Cambridge.
You're in Cambridge.
Harvard University, right.
And Fantastic. Hello from me too, John. It's just an absolute honor to have you in here. We've just read out a few things to our wonderful listeners that you've been doing, and we've told them that unfortunately we can't read out all of your capacities and achievements. And anyway, I'm just really, really honored to have you here. It's great. Thank you.
Would we be able to start with just a little bit of some career highlights of yours so that our listeners have an idea of sort of where you've come from in the world of neurobiology? Because you have a rather distinguished career.
I'd be delighted to do it. Actually, my scientific career goes way back to my undergraduate days at Harvard. And I was headed towards medical school. And in my junior year, I took a course with a man by the name of George Wall. Right. He was a fabulous lecturer. He also was a super scientist. He discovered the role of vitamin A in vision. I don't know how much we want to get into that, but of course, vitamin A aldehyde, a slightly oxidized form of vitamin A, serves as the chromophore for all of the visual pigments. That is, it's what absorbs the light and starts vision. And he won a Nobel Prize for that. Anyway, it was a biochemistry course that he was teaching, and he started off the first semester talking about the great metabolic pathways. Well, any one of your listeners and you, if you've had introductory biochemistry, that's really dull material. But he really brought it alive.
He did.
And so in the second semester of the course, I approached him and asked if I could spend the summer in his laboratory and learn some scientific techniques. And he accepted me into the laboratory. And when I got there that summer, I was just fascinated by doing biomedical research.
Yeah.
I studied first the photoreceptors and vitamin A deficiency. The last year at Harvard, I did nothing but work in the laboratory, and that was great fun. But I did go off to medical school, but after 2 years, decided to take one more year to do just research. So I took a leave of absence. I'm still on that leave of absence. This is the 60th year of that leave of absence. No regrets.
Wow.
So, I then got a PhD. It was before the days of MD PhDs. And after I finished that, I was asked by the department if I'd like to stay on for a few years as a junior faculty member and start my own laboratory, which I did do. And initially, I studied photoreceptors, the extension of the work that I did with George Wall on photoreceptors. But then one day, just after I had learned how to do electron microscopy, I made an interesting discovery, and that is that I knew virtually nothing about what else is in the retina besides the photoreceptors. Of course, everybody today knows that there are, in addition to the photoreceptors, four major types of neurons in the retina. And I was looking at the terminals of the photoreceptors, at the synaptic terminals, where they pass on information to the second order cells. And I noticed that one of the cells that we thought was a glial cell was making a synapse with the photoreceptors. And that fascinated me. And so started wondering what was going on beyond the photoreceptors in the retina. That started me off on an analysis of the retina that's kept me busy ever since. Well, more than 50 years. That what we thought was a glial cell has turned out to be a neuron. It's called a horizontal cell. Anyway, I became quite interested then in the wiring of the diagram of the retina. How do the neurons connect with one another? And we began to work out sort of the connectivity of the retina, if you will. From there, the question was, well, how do the neurons beyond the photoreceptors respond to light? And so with a graduate student, I began to record from the individual neurons, which we were just learning how to do at the single cell level at that time. This is back in about the mid-60s. And from there, we got interested in how do the synapses work? And of course, at that point, it was becoming clear that for the most part, synapses work chemically. That is, a neuron that's excited and is passing on information to another neuron releases a chemical that then either excites or inhibits the second order cell, and so on and so forth. So we went from photoreceptors to second order cells, and from there to the third order cells, of which there are two. The second order cells were horizontal cells, who I said just a little bit about. And then the second order cell is called a bipolar cell. It carries information from the outer retina to the inner retina. The horizontal cell, on the other hand, it keeps its processes within the outer retina and mediates lateral inhibition. So we then moved on from the outer retina to the inner retina. And again, there are two cells involved. One is called the ganglion cell that gets the information from the bipolar cell. It has a long axon that runs along the surface of the retina, collects at the optic disc and then carries that visual information from the retina to the rest of the brain. The other type of cell in the inner retina is called an amacrine cell. Very interesting cell, especially in those days, because it didn't seem to have an axon. In other words, all its processes were more or less the same. And in other words, the processes that it extended out, we call them dendrites, were in point of fact both pre- and postsynaptic.
Right.
And that, again, has turned out to be a very interesting finding. From there, we went on to try to understand then how the synapses work, the chemicals that they use to pass information from one cell to the next. And initially, we were interested in the major excitatory and inhibitory synapses, just like the rest of the brain. And I should emphasize that the retina is a true part of the brain pushed out into the eye during development. And the major excitatory neurotransmitter in the retina is the same as the major excitatory transmitter in the rest of the brain, glutamate. And the inhibitory transmitters we find in the retina are again the same as the major inhibitory neurotransmitters in the brain, GABA, gamma aminobutyric acid, and glycine. But then I had a visitor from Sweden come to the laboratory, and he was interested in other substances released by neurons, the so-called monoamines, serotonin, dopamine, epinephrine, norepinephrine, and so on and so forth. And he was curious, one, what they were doing, and two, how prominent were they in the retina. He had shown by using a specialized technique that there did seem to be a certain small cadre of cells that used dopamine. And that fascinated me, and spent then a number of years studying the effects of dopamine in the retina. And from that came the realization that rather than just exciting or inhibiting neurons, that dopamine acted more like a hormone. In other words, when it was released at a synapse on the postsynaptic cell, rather than opening or closing channels, causing fast excitation or inhibition, it changed the biochemistry of the cell. And indeed activated what we call second messengers that then had the capability of changing many features of the postsynaptic cells, changing, for example, how the channels that admit ions into the cell, how fast they act or for how long they act and so on and so forth. The neuromodulators, dopamine included, can change the metabolism of the cell as well. But even more exciting and interesting, and this was shown by a number of people, not so much our laboratory, but this was all happening in the 70s, that a substance like dopamine, when it activated a second messenger in a postsynaptic cell, actually could activate proteins called transcription factors that would then change gene expression in the cell. In other words, fundamentally changing the biochemistry of the cell. And that has been studied intensively since. We've gone on to study the genetics of the retina and so on and so forth. But neuromodulation really brings us to the main topic that I thought it would be worthwhile talking about today.
Yes,
and that
please.
Is that and through synaptic action, neuromodulatory synaptic action, the brain can be modified very substantially. And whereas we've long known that the young brain is very modifiable, and that goes back to the classic work of Hubel and Wiesel, Dave Hubel and Torsten Wiesel here at the Harvard Medical School, that indeed, whereas the major synaptic organization is present at birth, that if you change the light coming into the eye particularly focused light, that you can change the properties of the neurons very substantially and more or less permanently, although that's not quite right. At least that's our understanding today.
Right.
And so all of a sudden we came to realize that the brain is very modifiable, more so in the young, but now we have very good evidence that it's very modifiable, or at least partially modifiable, in adults. And the mechanisms underlying neuromodulation and that we had been studying in the retina are similar to those underlying memory and learning. And we can certainly all learn things throughout our lives. So the realization then that at synapses, not only can you excite and inhibit neurons, but then to modify the cells more or less permanently by changing their biochemistry, was a real paradigm shift in our thinking about how the brain works. So where does that get us to psychotherapy? Well, what we've come to realize is that virtually everything we experience can change the brain somewhat through such mechanisms. And what we know is that many of the drugs that we use to treat mental diseases, you know, like the dopamine antagonist and the serotonin antagonist or agonist, all are modifying synapses. And for the most part, what they're modifying are these neuromodulatory processes. And so we believe then that that's the way many of the drugs that have cognitive effects, how they're having it, at least on a longer term basis, is through such neuromodulatory effects. And so the guess is, and I think everybody who's listening recognizes this, that today when we treat mental disease, we believe that not only can drugs be helpful, particularly for those people who are quite severely ill and on a short-term basis, but combining that with psychotherapy is essential for getting the very best results. So what is psychotherapy doing? Well, I think my guess would be that psychotherapy, just like a drug that has cognitive effects, is affecting the brain through these neuromodulatory processes. So that in point of fact, drug therapy and psychotherapy, although you might think that they're very different processes, may be much more similar than indeed we have ever realized. In other words, anything we experience, is what I'm trying to say, does affect the brain in one way or the other. And whether it is done by giving something exogenously, like a cognitively active drug, or by psychotherapy, talking through things with people, trying to get them to understand pluses and minuses, if you will. And I am no psychiatrist, so maybe I am not really speaking very accurately. But clearly, I think, and it's my view, and it's what I wanted to say. To say is that psychotherapy and drug therapy are not as different as one might imagine. Intuitively, I think they're two different approaches, but in point of fact, I think they're much more complementary than that.
I was just going to say, because this is something that we've addressed. I mean, that's just such a wonderful lot of stuff for people to go back and deal with. But this, I mean, one of the posits that I've been putting forward is that the actual source of information for all therapeutic processes is actually the existing human being. And so when we're, it's exactly this idea that when we give somebody an exogenous thing, give them an L-DOPA pill or something to increase their dopamine, we're actually only doing something that has a natural or an already existing mechanism that it is assisting or aiding. And in fact, clearly the biology has been has worked this out and has been doing things to stimulate certain, particularly in the brain, neurochemicals and these modulating processes for thousands and thousands and for millennia. And one of the discussions that I've had is that to some extent, psychotherapy is necessary now to address the loss of therapeutic experience we get in natural life because we don't have such a natural life. Now we're recommending people go out and walk in nature 1 hour a week and that would be much better. And it's sort of like, well, sounds like a pretty good idea. And this interaction that you've discovered, and just one thing I just want to say before I leave it to you and another question, but you're talking about all this stuff back in the 60s. I mean, you were there when we were discovering the ideas of action potentials and...
I certainly wasn't around when action potentials were analyzed by... But certainly we did some of the first intracellular recordings in the eye or from any neurons and so on and so forth. So we certainly were there as neuromodulation was being worked out and some of the mechanisms of how dopamine in particular, which is the drug that we essentially focused on, exerts its effects. Through phosphorylation and so on and so forth, all of which has been developed enormously since we did that work.
Yeah.
But anyway, the main message I wanted to get to everybody, but maybe they already have it, and that's great, that indeed, you know, psychotherapy is altering the brain as well as drugs alter the brain. But I, you know, something else that I wanted to talk a little bit about that that I haven't been so much involved with, but have been fascinated by, is of course that we still know very little about the brain. And what we do know is that the brain is capable of modifying itself in very interesting ways through. Neurons that release substances about which we still know very little. And I think the nicest example in this regard, of course, is the placebo effect. And maybe you have discussed this already with other investigators, but I think everybody knows that if someone is feeling pain and they're given just a sugar pill and told that indeed, if they take this pill, that they will feel better, then in most cases, they do. What's going on? How can that be? Well, what we've come to realize is that by that suggestion given to somebody that indeed something will happen, it can happen. And whereas we used to talk about that as being, quote, psychological, there's a biochemical physiological basis for it, especially with regard to the placebo effect in relieving pain. That is what we now know, is that there are neurons in the brain that contain substances that act like natural opiates, the so-called enkephalins. I don't know whether you discussed that in detail.
Yes, we have at other times. The locus coeruleus is the source of that a lot, of, as well as the periaqueductal gray, and there are a few other interesting elements that we've discussed over the time over the years.
Yeah, I mean, but so, you know, we think we know a lot about the brain, and we certainly have learned a lot about the brain over the last half century, but there's still very much more to know.
Yeah,
I'm sure that the neurons that are releasing various substances that cause an enormous variety of mental effects, cognitive effects, we're just again scratching the surface. And what I'm talking really about are the so-called peptides. That is,
I was going to ask about that.
Small proteins consisting of anywhere from 5 amino acids to maybe 30 or 40 amino acids, which we know are present in the brain in relatively small numbers of neurons, but they can have quite fantastic effects. Again, the placebo effect and the enkephalins being really small 5 amino acid peptides, can have very dramatic effects.
I mean, this thing with ketamine and as an external, but the enkephalins, because of course people have been talking very freely about the endomorphins for many years, but it's actually the endokephalins, which and I've been looking at this in the last couple of years and getting a deeper understanding. And I think this is one of the aspects, is that because there is an argument about whether you need to know anything about the brain in order to be an effective psychotherapist. I'm certainly of the school that you need to know whatever you can know about anything in order to be a better psychotherapist. But I wonder what your thoughts are about this, the value and the usefulness of an understanding of the brain in being and having a better grasp of what it is you're doing as a therapist. Or I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, the title of my book that hopefully they were to send you, which is called Understanding the Brain.
Oh, yes, we've given a good plug, and we'll give more to that.
From Cells to Behavior to Cognition.
Yeah.
And clearly, you know, what I'm saying is that we start with cells, and we then see how they work. And that's where the great successes have been in neuroscience and neurobiology over the last 50 to 75 years, and understanding how individual neurons work. And that is how they receive information, how they process information, how they carry information, how they transmit information, and so on and so forth. That's the cells. But that doesn't tell us about behavior. And in behavior, what we need to do, and we're very much in the middle of this at the present time, is to understand how aggregates of neurons interact together to underlie behavior. Mm. Some of the greatest successes in this regard have been on studies of simpler animals, invertebrates, for example, in which they have simple behaviors, but one can begin to analyze those behaviors down to the cell and even molecular level.
Yeah, these deep understandings, when they're brought up, and this is what I think is valuable in the book, that you've done it in two parts. You've done it sort of, the first part gives you the nuts and bolts, which is valuable and important for being able to do, you know, if you're going to learn to be a car mechanic, you need to know about the bits and pieces. But it's the way that you then seek to put it together so one's from the inside out, and one's from the outside, you know, sort of top back down.
Exactly. I mean, I think that, the more that we uncover about the brain, the more then we'll be able to help severely mentally ill people, which, of course, is a major objective of psychiatry, of course. And, I'll say something else, and that is that we hear too often people poo-pooing drug therapy for helping patients. And what I recall, and it still resonates with me enormously. When I was in college, I spent a summer in a mental hospital, a state mental hospital in Rhode Island, where I lived. And in those days, there was nothing we really could do for severely mentally ill people. What did we have? We had electric shock treatment, insulin shock treatment, and then even on occasion, prefrontal lobotomies. Well, fortunately, we now have drugs that really have emptied to a great extent our mental hospitals. But drugs don't do everything. As we well know, they have side effects, and people all respond quite differently to drugs. But they've really been a huge, huge, huge plus for helping those people who are very severely ill. I mean, I can remember several of the patients that I saw in those days when I was a college student, that today I think we probably would be able to let them out into society. Yeah. But then, of course, one has to go beyond that
Yes, to life is not just surviving.
Those people manage their lives, and I think that, you know, that's enormously important.
Oof, Matt. I actually had a pretty good idea that John Dowling was important, and we sung his praises at the beginning. I'm a little I'm a little overawed by just who he was and what he did. His work with the eye, and of course he has fabulous. He sits on everything that is assisting blind blind people and blind associations. So he's doing enormous work with people to help there. So how terrific. Anyway, I loved this part of it. We do go on next week to talk more about, you know, applications in therapy and relationships of the brain and neuroscience to therapy, to therapeutic practice. But what a fantastic framework that he's given us in this half hour or so.
Yeah, brilliant. So let me just remind you again. So Professor John Dowling's book is Understanding the Brain from Cells to Behavior to Cognition, and we'll put the links in the show notes. And you will find that his book takes you through, just like he was in the podcast, he's taking you through the very beginnings of an understanding of, you know, neurons and glia, and going right through to the end, talking about cognition and consciousness and the bigger picture. So fascinating, broad scope of everything to do with the brain. So I encourage you to get that. So Richard, until next week.
Until next week. Here's second half, part two of John Dowling. Can't wait.
Okay. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning into the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. Catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.